ashamed about how many minutes of it I watched, but I also want to talk about it.
Okay, well, I don't believe in gender essentialism, but I do deeply believe that Reels are for boys and TikToks are for girls, because I do not watch Reels. I only have them sent to me by men.
See, that's interesting. I agree. I downloaded TikTok like 2.5 years ago when I was working at a job where I had to like do like TikTok videos, man on the street stuff, etc. But I swore I would never download it because I knew I'd get addicted to it, which I then did. So then I deleted TikTok as soon as I didn't have to use it for work anymore. But I started using Reels, which were great then because they weren't great because the algorithm kind of sucked. So I didn't get addicted, but now I'm as addicted to Reels as I was to TikTok 2 years ago.
You were doing man on the street interviews.
I was.
All right, roll tape. We're going to need to no, see that.
It's so embarrassing. It's so bad. The best performing one, I actually wasn't even in. I was just kind of I was standing to the side, but we were doing this thing where we would go up to kids or just people, you know, in where else but Washington Square.
You were harassing children in the park.
We were harassing children. Well, this time it was a Gen Z harassing fellow Gen Zs. I'm just, you know, I'm like a millennial cusp. Anyways, she asked them, "What's your favorite photo on your phone?" And this kid held up his phone, and it's a cover. It's a picture of the cover of Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs, the movie. But it just says balls. And that's what he said. He's like, "It's Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs, but it just says balls."
Just says balls.
And it got like 1.4 million views within a week.
That's a zoomer on zoomer crime. I think the millennial equivalent of that is the Nickelback, like, look at this graph.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I do. Well, that's what he was doing, basically. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think, though, that it's like, I don't know. I was rereading earlier Ryan Broderick Garbage Day essay from a couple weeks ago called The Age of Slop, where he's talking about all this and how much slop there is and how to be conscientious about not consuming it as much or not creating it as much. Let me read from it actually for a second. He says, "The fix for all this seems obvious and impossible, that it has to come from us, the user, the viewer, the consumer. And there's a lot of us now. We have to be the ones to demand that we all make less, aim smaller, be more deliberate about what we consume, and find new ways of funding and distributing what we do make." But he says, too, if it's going to happen, it needs to happen soon, because slop is only slop when you remember that what real food looks like. And the anxiety we're all feeling right now is that if our slop era lasts any longer, we won't remember what real food looks like anymore, which I feel like is kind of the thesis of why we started this podcast.
I see what you did there. Yeah, we'll be feeding you real food. Hope that's okay. Well, you know, in my capacity as the CEO of a media company, I am doing everything that I can to combat the slop era. I also have like called it filler.
Mm-hmm. You did write a great essay about this also a few weeks ago.
Yes, I did. And, you know, my company's called Dirt. So what's the opposite of slop? Obviously dirt.
Dirt?
Yeah.
Famously. You know, yeah, soil. Dirt, soil. You know, it's rich. Nutrients, minerals, etc. Yeah.
Have you been to the Earth Room?
I have been to the Earth Room, I think, like 3 or 4 times for, like, you know, 60 to 120 seconds each time.
That's a lot of times. That's more than I've been.
3 times.
What were you doing in there?
I was you know, observing the dirt, smelling the dirt. Actually, that's why I go there, is to smell the dirt.
Yeah, well, okay, so last time I was there, I felt like it wasn't as fragrant as it usually was, and I was wondering if they changed like
the
something
formula.
About yes. Yeah, so... I actually thought maybe it was something more about the room, that it was less humid or something.
Mm. Well, what time, when was this summer?
Yeah, it was like a month ago, maybe.
Is it air conditioned? It has to be air conditioned.
Well, that's the thing. Then I was like, maybe last time I went, like the air conditioning wasn't on and like the heat was on and it smelled different.
Mm-hmm.
I think the last time I went was in the winter.
Which is, yeah, very different.
This was only my second time.
Oh.
But now I'm like, I'm underperforming. Every time I'm in Soho, I should be like, you know, the cartoon with like the he's like smelling the pie and he's just like floating.
Oh, yeah.
That's like you in the Earth Room.
Being summoned to the Earth Room, which we should say to anybody listening who doesn't know what the Earth Room is, it's just like a room in Soho that would be like in New York. That would be like, I don't know, a 2-bedroom, 3-bedroom apartment. But it instead is like just at one big open room filled with like dirt. Like that's like 2 or 3 feet high, just a lot of dirt. Been there for 50 years.
I think it's such a good, I mean, I wasn't there on a date. I can't tell you what I was doing there. It'll be revealed. It'll be revealed at a future time. But I think it's like a great first date spot. Cause it's like, you take somebody to Soho, you get coffee.
You think you're like, going to Aritzia or something. I don't know. Blue and Green naming stores.
Yeah. Yeah. Know. Yeah. You think
Uniqlo.
You think you're going on a first date to Aritzia.
To Uniqlo. And, I don't know what I'm talking about. Sorry.
Bougie. No, you go to Soho, you're like, let's have a coffee. And then you're like, oh, can I show you something? And then, you know, with the utmost amount of riz, buzz into a random building and then walk up, you know, 2 flights of stairs and are like, look, darling.
Look it's all I've gathered for you.
It's a room full of dirt, baby.
Yeah. I've been gathering this for 2 years preparing for this date.
Nobody else knows about this.
Yeah.
They let me in here because I have a certain amount of credit card points.
Yeah. They let me in. Yeah. The Resi American Express dirt reservation.
Lounge. Shout out Ben Leventhal.
Mm-hmm.
He's Blackbird. Definitely listening.
Okay, we should talk about what this podcast is, basically who we are. So
I mean, I guess.
For a minute, and then we can dive back into the dirt.
Okay.
You know, actually I will say very briefly, personal lore. I wrote my college admissions essay about dirt, about how it was, because I grew up on a farm, right? So I wrote about how it was we had a pile of dirt on the farm, you know, many piles of dirt, but 1 6-foot pile of dirt. And they wrote about how it was my favorite toy growing up. And I got into 3 of the 10 colleges I applied for. So I don't know how effective it was, but here I am today. So I don't know. Personal lore for you.
All right. I was going to have a sarcastic reaction, but that almost made me cry because I love that so much. I think that's so beautiful. And you went to sort of an artsy school, right?
Yeah, I went... maybe unsurprisingly, having written about dirt, I did go to a 2,500 person liberal arts college in Portland, Oregon.
Yeah, liberal arts colleges in Portland are like, we got to get the dirt boy.
Yeah, we need the dirt boy.
Get him in here. Get him in here.
But okay, so Tasteland is this podcast. Yeah. It's starting now, July. It'll be first episode out, July 31st, 2024. Mm-hmm. How did it happen? I write this newsletter, Creator Spotlight, for Beehive, where I write about newsletter creators from all kind of corners of the medium, people making money from it, people not making money from it, people using it as a creative vehicle, people making $1 million writing newsletters. And I do a podcast and I interview people. But sometimes I want to keep the thread going. So that's where we come to this, which is a co-hosted podcast. So I think the way that we were connected was Beehive CEO Tyler, you guys had talked about doing a podcast before, but he doing what he does was too busy for that. So he connected us.
Yeah, he connected us. We were set up on a blind podcast date. We had one conversation. I think my concern was like, Creator Spotlight is so well put together, obviously, and like makes sense. You're spending hours doing research or highlighting aspects of the newsletter business that aren't necessarily highlighted otherwise. And I was like, is this guy going to be serious? You know, too serious for moi?
Did you think? No way.
Well, come on. So I saw a picture of you. It's like, I wasn't like, this guy grew up on a farm and he's going to be able to throw down. And then I got on the phone with you and immediately I was like, oh, thank God. He's a hater.
Mm-hmm. My picture is also terrible. It's like I've got like long, my hair is much longer than it was now. I'm kind of like posed up. The picture, it's not representative of who I am today. Anyways,
we could take a new one at the Earth Room.
At the Dirt Summit. Yes.
But yeah, no, like by hater, I just meant like, when I say hater, I don't mean somebody who never makes anything and just points at other things and mm-hmm. criticizes them. I mean, like, are you willing to be the one to say, everyone else liked this movie and I didn't like it?
To have an opinion.
For such and such a reason. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so when I got on the phone with you, I immediately was like, oh, he's like very real. Like, he's going to be able to, you know, he's not going to have to participate in this weird, like, optimism maxing toxic positivity that really pervades a lot of the the tech podcast space for sure. Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe not so much the culture podcast space, but like what we're really trying to do is something at the intersection of those two, where mm-hmm. we're trying to be more culturally literate, discriminating, better curated than maybe a typical tech podcast. Yeah. I don't want to say tech bro podcast, but I think we know who we're talking about
to here. Any listeners.
But to have a little bit of a better understanding of the ins and outs of venture capital, the startup environment, how businesses are funded, and the technology that distributes culture than the average culture podcast, which understandably might have a pretty antagonistic relationship with stuff at the category level, like AI at the category level, crypto at the category level. So that's what we're setting out to do. And I will say, like, so my job is I'm the CEO of Dirt Media. Mm-hmm. We are a startup and a media company. We're distributed primarily through newsletter, and we cover digital culture broadly. We have and are adding more subsidiary publications. We have one called Prune about design. Mm. I really feel like what I do editorially is also reflected in my Common App essay for college, where I wrote about my art practice in high school, which was I did a ton of paper cutting illustration, where I would do these like extremely intricate scenes all cut out of paper and glued together, like down to like, you know, a candy shop, where I would cut out every single individual piece of candy, and the pieces of candy would be so small. I was doing it with full size scissors too. The pieces of candy would be so small that I would have to be like balancing them on my fingernail before I would put them on the dot of glue. And there was an image in this essay about, you know, I would find random cutouts in my carpet because I had a little bit of a shag carpet. So I was constantly doing this excavation where I would like find later like a tiny little heart or like a tiny little bone. And it was almost like an archaeological dig. So, you know, my company is called Dirt because culture right now, digging through the slop, digging through the filler, bringing this back home, it's like an archaeological dig. We're like reaching into the shag carpet and being like, what of here is actually of value? Mm-hmm. And the things that we highlight as a business, but also the things that we and you, like our listeners, are highlighting in aggregate then become our taste. Mm-hmm. And taste as an idea, I argue, is the most powerful idea right now in culture and in business because of the rapid shifts that we're seeing in creation and distribution right now. And I think it is highly correlated with curation, but
so you use the word or the phrase taste economy a lot. Define that.
So like my thesis of the taste economy is essentially, you know, when you talk about businesses, you talk about moats, which is like your moat is the thing that prevents another company from coming and putting you out of business.
The thing they don't have.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, think about McDonald's and Burger King. Obviously, these things are constantly changing. But like when McDonald's is like, you know, we're going to have the Travis Scott meal, that means Burger King can't have the Travis Scott meal.
Yeah, Burger King Cactus Jack is hard to imagine.
Yeah. And obviously, like the moats go way back, right? It's like a huge history. It's like, do you see the golden arches and think about your childhood? I mean, these things are very, for companies as big as that, like you kind of know what your moat is, and it's impossible to separate out from nostalgia, history, American culture, you know, memetics, whatever.
Yeah.
Which we'll get into all that. But with a startup, it's like you're kind of defining it in real time, right? You have mm-hmm. no history, you have no name recognition.
Well, that's like your whole thing at the startup is you're trying to build a moat. Like you're like, yes, that's, you're exactly. desperately trying to build a moat as soon as possible.
Yeah. And I'm sort of arguing like when the cost of creation goes to zero or what mm-hmm. feels like zero or what is perceived as zero because things can be automated through AI, whether it's the creation of software, which look, if people aren't touching it, it's going to be pretty mediocre, but it might be passable yeah. for certain tasks, or a blog post or an art graphic. Where does the value actually accrue? And if you are a business right now, you kind of have, there's like three possible moats, right? You can have proprietary technology, something nobody else has access to. So, you know, we made Ozempic in a lab and there's no generic, right?
Yeah.
I mean, there is a generic now, but like pre-generic, right? Oh, wow. Like that's, you know, we created the most valuable company in Europe. Or like, you know, we're like toggling with LVMH for the most valuable company in Europe.
It was it? I actually didn't know that.
I think so. Yeah. I could be wrong.
Yeah. Well, it was up there.
Fact check that.
Yeah.
So yeah, like proprietary technology. Obviously, nobody else has the technology. Nobody mm-hmm. else can make what I make. That's my moat. Or supply chain innovation or infrastructure access where it's like, well, I have a salt mine. You don't have a salt mine. I have this many NVIDIA chips. You yeah. do not. So that's my moat. You do not have access to the raw materials. You don't have access to the factory. You can't drop ship what I drop ship. So you don't have the moat. Fine. Mm-hmm. Okay. So that's two. Anything outside that, I think it really comes down to taste. And some people would call it brand, storytelling, you know, whatever you want to call it. I think it really is, that's where the culture piece comes in, mm-hmm. right? Like if I have a salt mine, my website can be a landing page, you know, it doesn't matter. Berkshire Hathaway, I think, is like the company everyone cites where it's like the landing page is like GeoCities, whatever. Everyone else, like it doesn't matter if you're selling seltzer or you're selling payroll software. Mm-hmm. Like you got to be out there, you know, shilling your taste, telling the best story, like getting in people's heads, acting like a marketer.
Yeah.
Understanding the humanities, really. Go read your James Joyce.
Yeah.
Because you have nothing else that somebody else can't replicate, really. Until you do like user capture, right? Like, cause there is, you can do a lock-in, right? Mm-hmm. Like there are certain types of enterprise software, like the stuff that hospitals use, where it's like every doctor's using this, they can't switch. So that's another moat, essentially. Yeah. But that's not available to a startup, right? Because you're finding your user and building your community in real time. That community becomes the moat eventually. But the way that you attract them is through your taste.
Yeah.
People would say curation.
One thing I want to talk about in this. So I'm thinking, like, this reminds me of a few weeks ago. There was this, like, kind of tweet pile-on thing. I think it was like Willie Staley had tweeted.
Oh, classic Willie Staley. Oh, classic Willie Staley involved in a Twitter pylon. Yeah, who could have thought? Yeah. So
he tweeted, it was the Yellowbird hot sauce. And he's like, they did Graza. Everything looks like Graza now. Like this is Graza's fault, et cetera, et cetera. And then people who like were more in like the consumer packaged goods industry start like replying. It's like, actually, it's the same agency who did the branding. And like people are like, actually, or like, you know, Graza wasn't the first person to do squeezy balls, whatever. But what was interesting was like that it was the agency, and like that this agency has also done the branding for a bunch of other like CPG brands. And then I also mm-hmm. think of something like last decade, the equivalent of this was Ginlane, the agency Ginlane, which is now Pattern Brands, and they did the branding for like
Emmett. Away. We should have him on.
We should.
You know, like, Emmett too.
I know of his work. But anyways, they did all these. The branding for all these startup, like CPG startup brands, like Away, mm-hmm. Warby Parker, Sweetgreen, whatever. And then like, so the reason I'm talking about this is like, there is a moat at first where like this agency has this aesthetic and gives it to a brand. But then I wonder is like, does the agency then kind of degrade their own moat over time, over like a decade or whatever, after by giving all these different brands, you know, a similar aesthetic. Like there's mm-hmm. something similar. So like, I don't know. Do you think that like that agency branding moat degrades over time for like, I don't know, the agency who did Graza or for like a Gin Lane?
Well, I think there's a distinction, right? Because like they don't care. Once you've been paid your project fee, they don't care if you succeed yeah. or fail as a startup, really. But, so,
which
like,
also, though, I know, last thing I'll say, Gin Lane, I think they got equity in a lot of the businesses. They helped
okay, them. So that's good because you have skin in the game, but mm-hmm. you can't be totally invested in, like when you work with that many startups, you can't be like totally invested yeah, in making no. sure that they don't all
it's not like you have
start to converge
equity.
On a certain like millennial aesthetic or like, you know, that sort of hipster Helvetica moment. Like you want to do the best job that you can do. But honestly, like a certain type of startup founder is going to want something that looks familiar. They might be even asking and bringing a mood board of their competitors saying like, I want this, but better. So yes, they have skin in the game, but I think you don't, for the startups, certainly they need to be concerned that their brand and storytelling is not distinct enough.
Yeah.
For the agency, that's less of a consideration, I think, than not evolving quickly enough. Like mm-hmm. to be an agency, the aesthetic that you have used and pioneered, even if you were the first ones to come up with it, if it becomes stale, you can't sit there and be like, well, we were the ones to come up with this. Like you have to evolve. Yeah. And I think a good example of that is like, if you think about Brat as branding.
Yeah.
Brat
did special offer. I think the agency.
Yeah.
That did this.
Brat did what Brat was supposed to do, what Brat needed to do. Whatever this agency or Charlie or the team or, you know, the stakeholders along the line of the branding of this artist comes up with next cannot be Brat.
Yeah.
And people who, you know, any artist is looking at this and is like going to their agency and saying like, do Brat. But for me, like mistake.
Failure
right?
to understand. What
yeah. Like, I mean, the first five people might get away with it. The sixth person, no, because now it's part of the slop. It's mm-hmm. so easy to tune out. And so, you know, I think this is where the world of advertising really resembles the fine art world, where it's like, you could go to a museum and point to a Picasso or, a Rauschenberg. We just mm-hmm. wrote an interesting article about Rauschenberg and say like, I could do that or my kid could do that. And it's like, but you didn't.
Yeah.
If you were the 100th person to do it. Yeah. That's not that impressive.
Yeah.
Your kid could have made the Brat graphic.
Your kid could make the Dirt Room.
Your kid could, yes, your kid could absolutely make the Earth Room. Yeah. Yeah. Give that child a zin and they're locked. I'm so sorry. I have like, this is not mine. but yeah, like your child could do that, but they yeah. didn't. And you could do that, but you didn't. And you don't want to be the 10th person. You want to be the first. Mm-hmm. So I think part of the issue with slop or even with AI as a creator is like, are we going to see a failure to innovate?
Yeah.
And that failure to innovate, it is a built-in advantage for the human tastemaker, because I think the human tastemaker and critic mm-hmm. Sees innovation and evolution as a virtue, you know, a benefit, a skill set to cultivate, where you kind of have to always be like burning down the last thing you did, even yeah. if you're not literally, like it's still on your website, you're still proud of it, it's part of your portfolio, but what's
you have to
next?
Forget it, which is kind of a yeah. torturous existence, honestly. Like, I don't know. That's something I feel like I find hard is like something with Creator Spotlight, like my mantra I try to take with it is like consistent but not predictable. Cause like every week, yeah. right, I have to like interview a new person and write like a 1500 word essay about who they are and why they're interesting and like, you know, justify the person's reading it, you know, like that they spent their time well.
To bring it back to the startup environment, like it's pretty challenging because startups want to have a large total addressable market, which means yeah. from a consumer perspective, you're seeking the median. But when you're mm-hmm. starting out, you need to be an outlier. So you can't be seeking the median in kind of the taste that you're presenting or the innovation that you're presenting, but eventually mm-hmm. you have to appeal to a broad enough people or a small group of people who are going to pay a premium to use your product. And so you constantly have to balance kind of the general interest with whatever the special sauce is.
Yeah.
And if it's so new or so innovative that it's a turnoff, then you might have a problem.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think so.
Because you're in a race against time. Like, can you get the median adjusted to your outlier presentation, your outlier product, before you run out of money?
Yeah. Well, it's like to use like the metaphor of like, you know, a culture in like biology class, you know, and you like put the thing in the petri dish and it grows, right? Like, mm-hmm. I think with taste and like what you're saying there, like you want to have a really opinionated perspective that like is inherently going to be small because it, mm-hmm. you know, it has to be small to be opinionated, you know, to like have a compelling, new, fresh opinion. But then like your goal is, like you're saying, is to then like whatever the people are who resonate with that opinion, who find it compelling, who find it new, who find it fresh, you're trying to like make more people find that fresh. But it's like the conditions have to be right? Like in the petri dish, it has to be like the right humidity, the right, I don't know, whatever gel they put in those.
I mean, the right business tried 2 years too early, it's like not going to work. I mean,
yeah.
Well, I have very complicated feelings about Uber and Airbnb, but like those are, I mean, like, one of my investors, Maya Bakai, was just on a podcast where she talks about creating the market. Like the market for that did not exist. Like if you went on the street, man on the street interview, asked people, would you like to get in a stranger's car and
you'll
have
run.
Them take you where you're going for money? Like, is that interesting to you? It's like, no, that's not interesting. I don't want to stay in a stranger's house. Like, are you kidding?
Yeah.
And now it's like, we can't even really imagine like kind of life before that for a certain type of person.
Yeah.
And they're also like, now that they're the incumbent.
Mm-hmm.
So they created this market and now they're almost going to be like, they're going to be their own victim of the market because we look at them and say,
yeah,
look at all these problems you caused. Right.
I think with Airbnb, that's like, especially it's easier to talk about for me than Uber in that like so many Airbnbs you go and it just sucks where it's like, it's not actually somebody's house. It's not like it's like the landlord special, right? Where it's just like the cheapest bed, the cheapest everything, nobody lives here, right? But then like, and that's what I think of when I think of Airbnb. But like 2 weeks ago I was in Berlin and I stayed in Airbnb where I was like, oh, this person like actually seems like they might live here sometimes. Like it's clearly an Airbnb, but they might live here sometimes and it's like nice. And like we talked to them for like an hour when we checked in, right? So like I think that's the problem then. And like it's the same like the agency thing, like the degrading moat, like the something of like the, you know, that true opinionated appeal remains, but then like the rest of it is so diluted. And I think that's like, that's what the, you know, things just become diluted from the original interesting thing. And that's like the same thing with like talking about Brat, like the sixth person to come and ask for Brat, like, you know, I don't know what they want from it in this metaphorical scenario, but it's like, that's not interesting. That's not opinionated anymore. I don't know. The point is just that.
Yeah. I think one question we're going to be asking a lot on this podcast is like, can you scale taste?
Mm.
And do you have to scale taste in order to have a viable business?
No. I think yes and no. It's obviously a complicated issue.
We'll answer at a future date.
We'll answer this continuously.
So can I ask you, like, the farm that you grew up on, at what scale were you operating? Like, was it a farm that used machinery? Was it a farm that was...
Yeah.
Just your family's hands. Yeah.
Yeah. It's 8 acres. I think at any given time, maybe like 3 to 5 people besides my parents working on it. But it's like, it's small. And I think that, I mean, honestly, like, obviously, I think that shapes how I think about like taste and opinions. And I think like that most of the best things don't scale, which is such a like startup like truism now too, like do things that don't scale. But I don't know. I think it's just like more interesting to do things on a human scale. And there's some people who think it's way more interesting to do things on like the mass scale. And that's just not me. And like, I think it's interesting to like talk to those people and like try to understand them and, you know, learn about how they think. I grew up like selling stuff at the farmer's market with my parents and like handing somebody these tomatoes that we grew and that like I knew were so good because we grew them and I saw every part of their life cycle and I eat them. Right. So it's like, it's very easy to sell this tomato when it's just like so inherently unquestionably good to me. So I think that's like really a metaphor for like how I think about taste and cultural products. Like, I think it's really compelling and interesting to like find a way to do something really good on a mass market. I think like in, you know, cinema is a good way to think of that. Like, many movies can pull that off, because too, there's like so much funding, et cetera. But so much of the more interesting things are this more like person to person, hand to hand, these products, right?
That's so funny, because when Tyler and I did the deal for Dirt to acquire Prune, which was called mm-hmm. Sitting Pretty at the time, Tyler lives up near Hudson and I live an hour north of the city. So we met in Rhinebeck, and, you know, he brought me like a bag of tomatoes from his garden for like the best tomatoes ever. So we like did this handshake deal where I was like, you know, I'll give you such and such amount of money and we'll structure it like this and blah, blah, blah. And then he gave me a bag of tomatoes.
That's perfect.
I maybe got the better deal. I don't know. Uh-huh.
Were they like those Lueve, you know, heirlooms or?
Yes, they were. You have a picture somewhere. I'll send you. Yeah. They were all different colors, all different shapes. And so, yeah, I mean, I would say Dirt is very much a tomato business. That's how we mm-hmm. do business.
Yeah. bushels of tomatoes. Not even bushels of tomatoes. Bags of tomatoes.
It was a bag. Yes.
Yeah.
It's a plastic bag.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I want to talk about these two reels that I was talking about earlier. These two Instagram creators, one who I think is so representative of like the slop and that I felt so ashamed of. And then the other one, okay, anyways, so this guy, this like slop guy, have you seen these things on Instagram or TikTok where it's like, I consume a lot of soccer content, so that's mainly where I see it.
But it'll be like
perfect Calafiori to Arsenal today. Anyways. What was I gonna say?
Arsenal Italian sucks.
I know you're in it. Okay, well, your husband's a Spurs fan, right? I don't know if you are too.
Oh wow. Okay, so you remembered. I didn't remember.
Anyways, okay. So where am I with this? Okay, so these reels where it's like a list of numbers, mm-hmm. and there'll be like a football player's like picture pops up, and it's like you're blind ranking them or something like that. Mm-hmm. But there's this guy who his main thing, he does a few different ones, but it's like trying to get to 9,000 goals, and there's like he can do like career goals, triple goals, double goals, quadruple goals, and it's designed so that he always fails. And like I ended up on like Saturday or Sunday like sitting on my couch watching probably like 20 minutes, half an hour of this guy's stuff, and like there's like different versions of his game, but he always fails, and he's just kind of this like woeful looking guy with these like plastic facial expressions where he's like Neymar, you got Neymar, like I don't know, he's just always despairing, and he just like he's such a bummer. And I found myself watching, like waiting for him to win, because it's always like, oh, he gets to 8,733 goals, he fell short of 9,000, and then I started watching him and I would just skip to the end to like see if he wins, but he just always lost. And I blocked him because I was like, I just wasted half an hour of my life watching this, like falling victim to this, like, you know, slop arbitrage where he's just getting views by like being this like abject failure time after time. And so that made me mad. Huh. I think that's like the definition of slop. But then there's this other guy.
Do you think there's something like weirdly psychologically cathartic for people of like, I need to watch this pathetic guy fail?
It's like slapstick, right? It's like the clown who like steps on a rake and like gets hit in the face.
Right.
But then it's like, which is funny, but
clown is more hard.
Yeah, yeah, definitely more hard. But like after half an hour, you know, or however long I spent, I don't know, maybe it was long. I hope it wasn't longer, but it was just like, I felt bad. I felt bad having like wasted half an hour of my precious Saturday. And it was because it was so designed to like be binged because he keeps losing. And I didn't even realize I was just waiting for him to win. But like I kept watching because I wanted to see him win. And then I looked, I watched dozens of this guy's videos, skipping to the end. But, you know, in some of them, he never won.
You know, that guy goes to the hospital and they're like, you need to watch this reel of this guy who always loses at trying to get 9,000. And he's like, but doctor,
I am Razzle.
That's me.
Yeah. Okay, but wait. So the other guy I want to talk about, who at first I found myself displeased with, but then actually I found really compelling, and is a fitting metaphor for taste. His name is Tom Tries Food, and I think he's Australian. He's
that's just his kind full of, legal name, Tom Tries Food.
No, it's actually Tom Lawson.
It's like that old Do you remember that commercial? It was like Bob had a baby, it's a boy, where he gets it in on the collect call. Okay, so it's a, we have time. Okay.
Yeah.
So the commercial's like, I think it was AT&T, I'm not sure. Like, you know, you call somebody collect and they're like, it's a call from this person, do you accept? And then they have to either pay or you pay.
Oh, yeah.
So this person says that his name is Bob had a baby, it's a boy, and then just like hangs up because that's their like, there's like call from.
Yeah.
And then the transmission. So anyway, I was like, tongue tied food.
Wait, this is, wait, but this is a commercial. Why is that? Like, is he?
I don't know. I think they were advertising their rates were lower or something. Like, oh, you don't have to call collect.
You just say it.
Weird shit. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. I get it. Okay. Anyways, this guy, Tom Tries Food, he's like this just like skinny guy with a mullet, nice smile, Australian.
Okay.
And his whole thing is he has a food phobia. So each video, he's like, today I'm going to try coffee for the first time. And he
that's a really good accent.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. He'll try these foods, and I'm at first like, oh, that's so weird that he like doesn't like a cookie, like he's like cringing at it. But then I watched one where it's like, here's my taco recipe. And his taco recipe is like, he just takes a hard shell taco, breaks it in half, puts some unheated up canned beans on it, and then some ketchup, and eats it.
No.
And exactly. And then there's a few others where he's doing like his recipes, and it's all this kind of like really sad thing. But then like the point is that like, okay, that's his taste is slop. But he has like some food phobia, whatever. But then like I've started finding it so admirable that he like is trying these things where he's like trying like Malaysian food and it's too spicy for him. And he takes a, you know, a bite. And he's like, oh, it's awful. But then he like, I don't know. The point being this, like this act of like creating your own taste and like exploring your taste and like pushing against like your preconceived notions of taste that are like so deeply entrenched, where he must be in his mid to late 20s and like, you know, eats cold beans on a chip and calls it a taco and that's his dinner. So I guess what I'm getting at is like, it's interesting and compelling to like push your own taste and like go try new things. And that's what he's doing. Whereas like the other guy was just doing like attention arbitrage.
Right. I mean, taste means there's like human stakes at some point. You might be really far removed from them. Like, I think, you know, if taste to you or your experience of taste is getting like a starter pack meme on like Essence's Instagram page, like you're not going to feel a lot of human stakes in that. But
because that's already like sublimated a few times.
Exactly, sublimated. Mm-hmm. But, you know, with this other guy, like there's really no layer between you and his phobia or you and his like weird habits. And in a sense, he's performing them for you. But you're feeling more of a sense of humanity from the thing that initially repelled you.
Yeah.
And I think a good critic is directing people towards stuff that's like gonna maybe initially repel you, but if you're able to
learn the contours of it,
go through some experience of it, it's gonna be ultimately more edifying whether you like it or not, because taste is not as binary as I liked this or I didn't like it.
So this guy too, he has now like 9,500 followers on Instagram. I think when I started seeing his reels there were like 7,000. So do you think, like, I don't know, if he keeps, you know, soon it won't be the full long number. It'll just say K at the end, right? So I'm wondering, like, though, as he grows. So, like, the slop guy I was talking about with, like, the terrible soccer reels, he has, like, 160,000 on Instagram. And so clearly he's, like, leaned into it because it kept working, right? So I wonder with this guy, like, this Tom Tries Food guy, he's so earnest and there's, like, a sweetness to it. There's one where he's trying Guinness. He's not a big drinker, so he tries an alcohol-free Guinness, which, you know, everyone's drinking Guinness these days. I love my Guinness. I hated it when I first tried it, whatever. But it's like the angle's like from right below him and he's sipping it. He's like, oh, this is awful. But you hear his friends, he's like looking at his friends out of the off camera. He's like looking at them, they're laughing. He's like, you like this? No offense to any Australians listening. But I don't know.
Full offense from me.
Oh, full offense to you. But yeah.
No, I'm kidding.
I don't know.
Earnestness is a beautiful quality. I think we've had some writing in Dirt recently, especially about the literary community and subcultures of book publishing, where people are really still trying to figure out the spectrum between earnestness and irony, especially in stuff that's like would be considered like an internet novel or novels that are sort of like
your first novels or whatever.
Exactly. In our Greta Rainbow's piece about Honor Levy's new book, where she's not just talking about Honor Levy's book, she's talking about this kind of post alt-lit era.
12 years after Taipei.
Exactly. See, this is why you and I have to be on a podcast together, because we have the same references. And you would never know from our LinkedIn photos.
No, Lord.
So, yeah, shout out Talyn. I hope your cats are doing well. Please stop burying cheese in your yard. anyway, where was I going with this? Oh, yeah, like the earnestness and irony spectrum. Yeah. Like, that's part of taste, too, right? I think some people are turned off by earnestness. My hot take is if you're turned off by earnestness, you
hate yourself.
Have fear. Yeah, you fear and shame of earnestness in yourself. It's difficult to witness it in others. But probably, Francis, I don't want to psychoanalyze you, but it's possible that you have some sort of fear of failure in yourself that made the other guy more repellent to you. I know.
Yeah. So this earnesty irony thing. When I was in college, and you know, everyone's like, it's Portland, Oregon in the 2010s, and everything.
It's Portland, Jerry. Forget it.
Yeah, and well, yeah, it's Southeast. Anyways, people are liking things ironically, right? Mm-hmm. And I, at a certain point, I was like, well, does that exist? Like, can you actually like something ironically? Like, or at a certain, like, maybe you can at first. Mm-hmm. Like, maybe you're listening to, I don't know, whatever, like, song that is like trendy, and maybe at first you're like, oh, I ironically like that. And maybe this was just me, but I like don't know if you can like something ironically in the sense that people talk about liking something ironically, or at least did, you know, other 19-year-olds did when I was 19. Like, does that exist, or can you only like something earnestly, and if you think you like it ironically, you're just like hiding some fear from yourself?
I would say, because we live in an attention economy where so many things are competing for attention, if you like something ironically, you are investing time and attention in it more so than things that you claim to like, then you have a stake in it, right?
Yeah.
Like, if you're making that attention investment, even if you're making that attention investment ironically, it's sort of like what people talk about with like revealed preferences. Like,
yeah,
you're revealing something about yourself. It's like going on 5 dates with a guy and be like, I really hate this guy, I'm just doing it for the story. And it's like, date 6, you're in love.
Yeah,
right? Like,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think this is probably a good place to end our first episode. If you've listened to 45 minutes of this, you probably like it, or however long this episode
is. You love it. You're all in. We'll see you next week.
We'll see you next week on Wednesday. Thanks.